What's up, guys? Welcome to the Humans of MarTech podcast. His name is John Taylor. My name is Phil Gamache. Our mission is to future-proof the humans behind the tech so you can have a successful and happy career in marketing. What's up, everyone? Today, we have the pleasure of sitting down with Amrita Mathur, VP of Marketing at ClickUp. Amrita kicked her career off at OpenText in Toronto, where she wore many different marketing hats and later progressed to Red Knee as a product marketing manager. She briefly shifted to customer success at Jonas Software, concentrating on customer growth, retention, and later returned to product marketing at Toronto Region Board of Trade. She then became director of marketing at Price Metrics, a McKinsey company, where she led marketing planning and team hiring. She also led Demand Gen at Vision Critical, where she focused on go-to-market strategies, Demand Gen, and MarTech. Amrita then moved over to Top Hat as VP, overseeing Demand Gen, Marketing Ops, as well as growth. She then joined a startup called Consus, founded by two Norwegian entrepreneurs who secured seed funding from Sam Altman and the Slack Fund. She led the rebrand for the company to Superside and built a team that helped the startup grow from 0 to 4 million in year 1 and up to 60 million by year 4. Finally, Amrita has recently joined San Diego-based ClickUp, the powerful productivity platform valued at over $4 billion. Known best for their Super Bowl ad and their music album. Amrita, I know you've had a hella busy month this month. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. And that, wow, my whole life just flashed before my eyes. Like, that was just like, that's what I've done my whole life and my career. Oh my gosh.
This episode is brought to you by our friends at Knack. Launching an email or landing page in your marketing automation platform shouldn't feel like assembling an airplane mid-flight with no instructions. But too often, that's exactly how it feels. Knack is like an instruction set for campaign creation, from establishing brand guardrails and streamlining your approval process to Knack's no-code drag-and-drop editor to help you build emails and landing pages. No more having to stop midway through your campaign to fix something simple. Knack lets you work with your entire team in real time and stops you having to fix things mid-flight. Check them out at knack.com, that's K-N-A-K, and tell them we sent you. This episode was brought to you by our friends at Customer.io. Oversold on a legacy marketing automation platform that is still struggling to update its user interface, I've done a tour of duty with all the major marketing automation platforms, and many are definitely similar, but Customer.io is the most intuitive and beautiful platform. I'm talking about the industry's top visual workflow builder to design and implement your unique messaging strategy, powerful A/B testing features inside your workflows, not just on subject line sends, holdout testing functionality to see the incremental impact to your messages, queue draft mode so you can QA messages and conditions in production with real users before anything is sent, copy workflow items so you don't have to repeat the building process again, and monitor campaigns, tests, and keyless membership growth from your personalized dashboard. The icing on the cake, marketers using Customer.io have seen a 20% increase in conversion rates from strategic messaging. So stop using clunky old tools and adopt a multi-channel approach that creates joyful interactions with your customers. Start a free trial without a credit card at customer.io and tell them we sent you.
But yeah, my first start, I know you said OpenText, is because the funny story is I had to work for a company called Zenos, horrible name with an X. And I was like, is this a ode to like xenophobia? Like, what is this? But anyway, Zenos got acquired by a company also that doesn't exist anymore. And they got acquired by OpenText. So it's been like, it's like the shark eating the tuna eating the baby fish.
Gotcha. Yeah, LinkedIn's good at just updating the company names, and it looks like it was OpenText from the start of your career.
Yeah, exactly. So I've been in startup my whole life. I'd say this job at ClickUp is like my first proper like big tech, big company jobs. And they're not even actually that big. Like we're like under 1,000 people. I think we're like 800.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still definitely bigger than a lot of the startups that you at least like started your career at. And I know that, you know, $4 billion valuation, no big deal, 1,000 plus people. You're almost in this like ivory tower now at the VP level, big tech, maybe missing getting your hands dirty. How do you find the role so far? Are you still getting your hands dirty? Walk us through that.
Yes, there is no ivory tower. It's a fallacy. I'm the janitor and the VP and the copywriter and all sorts of stuff. I think the thing at ClickUp is a bit unique, where it's a It's a very flat org. You know, I think everybody, all big tech has been stripified. I don't know if that's a bad word, but like it's sort of like the Stripe model. Like everything's super flat. Even though there's growth, everybody has visibility into everything. It's like very operationally focused, especially given what we do. But it's like everyone's in the ops and everyone's kind of like knee deep in it. And our CEO talks a lot about, you know, people. He says it very simply, like people need to be in the details. To be effective, you need to be in the details. He's like, we can't like skim surface level. Like you have to know all of the ins and outs of everything. Otherwise, like don't show up, you know? So no, there's no, I wouldn't say there's remotely anything like an ivory tower. I would say if anything, maybe at the end of my thing at Superside after 4 years, maybe there was some ivory tower where I could like literally like walk away from something because the team's got it. But no such pleasure here.
One of the things we talk to with a lot of our guests, and I love your perspective, is just this concept of testing and in growth marketing. You know, we often talk about and kind of joke, you know, offhandedly that if you have a disagreement on marketing, just go ahead and test it. But not everything has to be a test, right? But with ClickUp's volume of signups and web traffic, no doubt that you guys have the velocity to be able to test things. So maybe walk us through kind of your approach to testing and what things need to be a test, what things we can just make decisions as marketers.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's this the fallacy in marketing that everything should be tested. I think you kind of alluded to that just now. That is not possible, and I think it can kind of drive you a bit nuts, and it actually pushes out decision making quite often. We do have high volume of signups. We do get a lot of web traffic, but it's not equally distributed. So just a simple example would be, you know, we need to spruce up our landing page that talks about our enterprise solution, or we need to spruce up. We're just literally working on this. Like I just launched an AI product for us called ClickUp Brain. And yeah, we're going to send a ton of traffic to it, but we have zero traffic right now. It's like a new thing. There's been no data. We have nothing. So at some point, you just got to make those decisions, make some, you know, have some good hypotheses. Do a bit of research to see like how else people are doing it. And my philosophy is like try to like zag a little bit from the zig. Don't do what others are doing. Try to be very, very different. And if you look at our AI page, clickup.com/AI, you'll see a little bit about what we mean. We've kind of broken a lot of the rules of like standard like landing page conventions and whatnot. And it's still converting really well. We have something like 10,000 signups to our launch party that's happening on Tuesday, just as an example. So like there are things that you can, you know, you can marry different disciplines in marketing to come up with something cool and unique that doesn't have to be tested in that way. Now that we've had that traffic, in a couple of weeks, we will start A/B tests. Of course, I want to drive more conversion. Of course, I want people to be like raising their hand and saying, I want a demo of this thing or sign up or whatever, right? So we'll start that in the next couple of weeks, but not at the outset. That's at least how I've tried to operate. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff in the not testing bucket, which, you know, you won't know until you observe the data. And frankly, maybe even those things don't need to be observed. For example, maybe I want to advertise on your podcast. How would I actually test that? How would I really know that if I'm on this podcast and you know, we do this for 3 months or 6 months, that there was like a lift in brand awareness and that people actually Googled us? Would be very, very difficult to test. So I wouldn't like burn cycles on that. That is more like who listens, like who's the audience? You know, do I believe Phil about like how many people are actually listening and downloading? Okay, I do. All right, great. This is for us, right? That's kind of what it is.
Yeah, we'll show you screenshots from Transistor for download numbers. Yeah, we can talk offline about this for sure. I'd love to like go back to Superside. So like this idea of testing in the early days, you know, obviously even pre-rebrand, there wasn't probably a ton of traffic, right? Like you were starting from scratch. And I don't know if that was the case for you, but at startups for me, the thing that like the C-level folks love is volume of experiments, like number of tests, like how many experiments that we'd run, like what did we learn from it? How did you like handle that? And maybe that wasn't the case for you, but like what advice would you have for listeners that are in those shoes that don't have the volume of traffic to get anywhere close to SatSig and feel like there is any validity in like the results of an experiment that had like hundreds of people that went through it. Like, how do you deal with that with the C-level folks saying like, we need experimentation. That's how companies are growing.
Yeah. I haven't had anyone like say you need velocity of testing, more like velocity of learning. Like, that's at least what my boss, Matt, the CEO at SuperSide, used to say to me. And he said that to me very, very early on when I was like freaking out and being like, how are we going to make our first million? He was just like, don't worry about the money. He was like, just worry about, can you and the team, the small ragtag team of three people we had, you know, like, can you guys like learn really fast? And he was like, that could be qualitative or quantitative. It doesn't have to be like one or the other. So, you know, one of the things we had done was to just throw up a bunch of landing pages and just put a ton of paid media against it to see if we could get to that statistical significance and test, like, essentially we were testing like value props and seeing like what's sticky, where do people scroll, where they stop, where they click, where they convert, blah, blah, blah. But then we also had to learn about a whole bunch of other stuff. Like, if we were to cold call a company, what do we say? How does that go? Should it be human powered? Should it be AI powered? Should it be, you know, do we want them to do a trial with us, or do we actually just want them to like come to like something else, like maybe like a webinar or something? Like, what, that type of qualitative testing is also helpful and valid. And it allows you to kind of see which funnels to build, how much to invest in the different parts of marketing. Like, for us, it turned out that our content marketing engine would not necessarily directly, you know, in an attributed way, like produce real pipeline in that way. Like, it wouldn't look like that, but we created this like really big aura, and almost one or two out of every sales call, the prospect would automatically reference like, oh my God, I love you guys on LinkedIn. I love your Instagram. It's so funny, or whatever, right? Like, they would say, they would volunteer that information on their own. And that's like when we weren't asking. So like 2 out of 10 were like just volunteering that. So we knew that some of the things we were doing were working from a content marketing and social media perspective. And you won't know that often until you actually try and it's out there in the world. And that feedback loop is delayed, sadly, but it is what it is. That's marketing. I'm pretty sure Coca-Cola doesn't know if the billboard campaign they did for the polar bear, whatever, like, I don't think they have that feedback loop like right away either.
That's such a smart take on that. And I kind of had a follow-up question that you actually kind of took the words out of my mouth a little bit. But as marketers, I think we've been spoiled by like direct response analytics. Like, I do something on the internet and now there's signups. I can attribute that and bring that to somebody and say, look, success. But marketing is full funnel. Marketing requires brand building and awareness, those billboard type things. What is kind of your approach and your advice to folks who are coming into marketing thinking about, how do I build a brand to be a, you know, from a startup from 0 to 1 million to 4 million? How do you invest? How do you make those justifications to your team and to the folks in the organization, like your stakeholders, like a CEO?
Yeah, there's so many levers and there's so many variables. I would say like, it really depends on the risk appetite of the company and the founders. And I've met all sorts of different founders and everybody's different. I was very lucky at SuperSide. Like, they were just like, we're going to go big or go home. He was like, if we go bust, it is what it is, but we're going to give it a good shot. Right. So that was liberating because now you're like, oh, I can actually go out and do these like 5 different things and see what happens. And yeah, I might not have a job in 6 months or whatever, but you know, I can go do that and figure it out. And it really felt like I had permission to do that. I have friends in companies where the risk appetite just isn't there and they want to do this like slow burn and preserve their cash flow. And like their runway is only like 18 months or what have you. And it's a whole different ballgame. So there's no playbook, I have to say. The only thing I can advise is that, and what's been successful for me is like, get like that agreement early on as to what do the leading indicators, like what does a good leading indicator look like? You're not going to get to success right away, but what is a great leading indicator? How do you know that you're on the right path? Get that agreement with whoever, the powers that be, and then you just gun your way to that. You know, so that could be, again, I'll just use SuperSide as an example. We knew we wanted to rebrand And we knew that a good way to test the whether the rebrand is working, which didn't just include the name and the logo, but the whole value prop and who we were going after and the personas and whatnot, we knew that a good leading indicator would be, hey, if we spent the exact same, you know, 10,000 or 20,000 we were spending every month, could we actually get more people to sign up for meetings with us? Just that. Maybe we don't close them. Maybe our price is wrong. There's a whole bunch of other things, right? Can I just get that person curious enough to book that meeting with us? That was a great leading indicator that we agreed on. And we showed as soon as we rebranded that that skyrocketed. So we were like, we're onto something. Great. The persona is right. The value prop is right. All right, now let's scale this puppy, right? So it's sort of like you just like backtrack the funnel. Like it's all the work that we normally do. We say, hey, how am I going to make $1 million in the first 4 months or whatever? And then you just like find a spot in the funnel where you all agree that if we could get to that, we would be happy.
That's a great point. I like the analogy of backtracking the funnel because I think folks often focus either right at the top of the funnel or at the bottom of the funnel when it comes to either branding or like, are we launching this new campaign or not? But I know that like, I don't know how different it is with ClickUp now. Like it's almost a different industry. Like you're kind of in MarTech now. I know marketers are probably like definitely the persona or like a part of the use case for the product.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a very different industry. And I will say that what I've learned is that, so it's the first truly horizontal product that I've worked for, right? It's like anyone can use ClickUp, like literally anybody. We have people I watch sometimes the signups, like, and like from our community oriented events, like users will tell us like what they use us for. It'll be like wedding planning. At my wedding on ClickUp, I met a guy at a trade show once who said that he was like, oh, my organization will never buy ClickUp. He was like, but I love ClickUp. And he showed me these amazing automations he had built so that they had estimated how many days it takes for the milk to run out, for example. And it would, that automation that would put it on the grocery list. So him and his wife could see it. Like he had like the most intricate stuff figured out. It was so funny, but it was like ClickUp was their household like CEO kind of, or COO, you know, but they had just automated all these like little silly things. So people use it for all sorts of stuff. It's a truly horizontal product. And we have a number of buyer personas and ICPs to go after, which is not a marketer's dream. Actually, I thought it would be because our TAM is huge. Our TAM is gigantic, but it's not a marketer's dream because you kind of have to market to marketing and creative and like engineering and, you know, HR and like all of these different people have different problem sets and different value props and, you know, different pains how manifest in different ways. And it's just like running five businesses under one.
Yeah, no kidding. I definitely echo some of those sentiments at WordPress. Like similarly, people signing up to build a website for like anything from a photography site to like a wedding site. And I'm curious to hear like how you guys are tackling this and what you can share. But we almost had this kind of like bowling pin strategy where we looked at who were the most valuable signups from like an end LTV revenue perspective. Yeah. And we would just like go back at the top of the funnel and focus on that one bowling pin first. So like agencies and like B2B companies were like a big bowling pin for us. We ended up like pivoting part of the business to WordPress VIP to focus on more enterprise deals. And then we had like different teams within the company that would almost focus on like, it was the same product, but we were just like messaging it differently. So yeah, curious what you can share there.
Yeah, no, pretty much the same. We have sort of, you know, four or five very core ICPs. Two of them are industry specific. And then, you know, the what you would guess, like we do really well with agencies as well. Interestingly, we do really well with marketers because often I think marketing tends to be like extremely cross-functional across the company. So they have like a greater need for having their shit together, basically. So that's a great value prop for us. And we've actually also found that a ton of, you know, we have an internal term that we just call EPD, but it's basically that engineering product design trio, that group together also has similar challenges as marketing. Not as cross-functional as marketing, but within the three of them, that group had a lot of challenges. So those are the three from a buyer persona perspective that we go after. They're like this, we have a lot of volume of need, but we also have lots of stickiness and the CAC payback and the LTV is amazing on them. So that's where marketing, my team focuses a lot.
Gotcha. Very cool. I want to ask you about the tech stack from going from Superside to ClickUp. Like on the outside, I thought, you know, the tech stack was going to look very different going to a much bigger company, but there was a ton of growth at Superside. And like, I'm curious to hear like the journey from like starting from almost nothing to like where you guys left off. Like I was looking at the code on the site and you guys had like Mixpanel, HubSpot, SixthSense, VWO, Datadog, Dream Data, Segment, Wistia, Salesforce, like a ton of tools.
Yeah.
And at ClickUp, similarly now, Census, shout out for the sponsors on the show, Marketo, Full Story, Clearbit, Datadog, Segment, Salesforce, Wistia, Contentful.
There's lots
maybe
more.
A little bit more, but yeah, curious your takes there. Like what was that surprising to you? Like how much do you get your hands dirty in MarTech these days?
Yeah, I actually don't. We have a pretty amazing data team and we have a separate but like adjacent MarTech team, marketing ops team that actually doesn't live under me. They're like more like a centralized function that support a lot of the other groups.
Okay, very cool.
Just to take a step back, the way that ClickUp's organized growth is there's like the user funnel, if you will, which is the PLG motion, like get people into the freemium product, doesn't matter what they use us for. Then can we retain them for 3 days, 7 days, 14 days, so on, right? So that PLG, the user-centric machine, is related but separate from the more like top-down mid-market enterprise marketing machine, which is what I'm running. So it's like data and ops kind of sits in the middle and they power both of our funnels, so to speak. There's overlap, but they're not the same. My boss explains it like in the simplest way. He was like, you're attracting buyers and the PLG machine, users. And those users might be buyers, but they may not all be buyers. And we have some data that shows which ones might be which. But there's a whole stack that I was not familiar with. For example, we just implemented something called Topline, which is a very classic ML model for qualifying where's usage inside your accounts. They look at it at the account level. Where's usage happening inside your accounts? Which usage is, I'll just call it, positive usage, like, you know, like return users, et cetera, et cetera. So there's like some scoring mechanism. And then which of those accounts actually have a shit ton of white space? So they look at that as well. So like maybe it's like a 5,000 person company and we only are being used by 500 people, right? So it's like, ooh, white space is high. And then it stack ranks every account that we have. So that is super valuable for me because I'm like, okay, expansion. How am I going to expand into Walmart, Coca-Cola, whatever, right? And it stack ranks everything. And I map it by geos as much as I can based on the billing state, which is kind of messy because like people don't live where the headquarters is. But now I know, oh, there's a hub in Dallas for us. Oh, there's a hub in like Austin, Texas, or there's a hub in Santa Clara or Palo Alto, whatever that looks like, right? Like I can now say, okay, my expansion funnel is in these hotspots. And by the way, these accounts, essentially my ABM program, because of Topline, is let me just go after those stack brand accounts exactly. And I refresh that like every month or so. It doesn't change much, but every month or so, I'm just like, okay, here are the new accounts that we're going to do ABM after. So that was a new product for me that I hadn't used in the past. We also have powered our sales reps, the few sales reps that we have, with something called POCUS, which just allows them to kind of see like what's happening inside the account, what the interesting moments are. And then they can choose to like kind of like in certain playbooks around that. So yeah, those are two new ones for me. And then of course there's like the standard like Platoon and that whole mixed bag of like looking at work, you know, signups and who's progressing to checkouts, who's actually purchasing, who's not, what's the fallout rate, which ICPs, which users are actually progressing, so on and so forth.
It's a pretty fascinating to kind of get a glimpse into how you approach, you know, marketing both on the PLG side and the more specifically that mid-market enterprise component. Like marketing is such a multidisciplinary industry department, whatever you want to say.
This episode is brought to you by our friends at Revenue Hero. I can't think of anything worse than finding out a lead waited a week for a response from sales. That's why we recommend Revenue Hero. It's the easiest way to qualify leads based on form values or enrich data and route them to the right sales rep. Their product is packed with a bunch of behind-the-scenes superpowers that ensures qualified leads are assigned to the right reps following your custom round-robin rules and sending key data back to your CRM. That means more qualified meetings for your reps. We all know they want more of those, but more importantly, no more waiting time for your potential customers. They back all of this up with the best product support out there, offering 24/5 support on Slack Connect for all customers, no matter your pricing plan. So if you want to 3x your conversions with the same traffic, go to revenuehero.io and tell them we sent you. Your sales team will thank you for it. This episode is also brought to you by our friends at Census, the number one data activation and reverse ETL platform, loved by Activision, Canva, Sonos, Notion, and more. As you might know, I'm pretty opinionated that the future of MarTech is composable and that the single source of truth for your marketing data should be your data warehouse. Census helps marketers solve an age-old marketing problem, getting real-time, complete access to your customer data without needing to write a line of code. Also, if you want your own face as a Humans of MarTech style image, we're doing a fun monthly raffle with Census for a personalized t-shirt. Enter to win at getcensus.com/humans.
I believe you report into the chief growth officer, and this is kind of like a representation of like the marriage between product and marketing. How do you think that marketing has evolved like over the last, 10 years? Like the PLG kind of encapsulates this a little bit, like marketing teams now work really closely with product, but like, talk to us a little bit about how top-tier companies like ClickUp are kind of combining those functions a little bit, like the product people and the marketing people sometimes are two halves of the same whole, looking at the same metrics and just using those metrics in slightly different ways to have outcomes for the customers.
Yeah, it really depends on your business model. So I think what's good about ClickUp is that they've embraced sort of like more like classic or traditional marketing and layered it on top of the product-led motion, which is very much about user growth and using the product to grow your user base and retain them and keep them happy, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of our marketing happens inside the product. Again, just like small things, right? Like we launched this AI product, and like so much of my work and the launch strategy was actually inside the product. We have millions of users that we wanted to toggle on AI, you know, and we can't do that just because of the way like privacy laws and whatnot, you know, we can't do that for them. So we had to really market to them to toggle that AI on. And then at the account level, also they have certain permissioning, et cetera. We didn't want the admins of the account to freak out and blah, 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 blah. So all of that marketing actually happened inside the product. We had like little pendos, you know, like little banners and modals. And like certain usage-based triggers. So if you did this, then this would turn on, like stuff like that, right? That's not like traditional marketing. Lots of people would just call that growth. But that lives, you know, with the growth team. And this trend has been around for like a solid 5-6 years. Like Pendo is like a huge company now. So many other companies use them. So that's pretty like interesting and new. But I think ClickUp, similar to some other giants in the space, have really like embraced both the PLG and the traditional marketing, which has been interesting. And actually, I don't know if this is an indicator of something of a larger trend or not, but I'm thinking it is. I think we're at the cusp of something. Our chief growth officer just got promoted to COO, and now he's also taken on customer success, sales, and support. So if you think about all of the growth functions of a company, like the things that are actually driving dollars, marketing, growth, sales, support, like all of this is under one roof. What's not under him is finance, rev op, like field ops, what we call field ops. Rev ops is split into two things, product and engineering.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. I find that fascinating. Mm-hmm. So from chief growth officer to COO, overseeing success, support, and like product plus growth / marketing.
Yeah, every revenue function. And I think it's
very cool.
I think the larger trend here is that companies are finally recognizing that these are like extremely intricately interconnected ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And it just maybe doesn't make sense for them to be pulled apart by hierarchy or any of that. And ClickUp similar to many other companies, is on a path to efficiency. Like, we want to IPO. We're not going to IPO if our stuff is just like, you know, we're spending a dollar to make a dollar. So this path to efficiency and like looking at the LTV and placing those bets kind of has to be unified sort of thing. So it kind of all makes sense for us, but I think it's at the, I think it's the start of something bigger across the industry.
It's really refreshing to hear you talk as the VP of growth, focusing on, you know, not just like top of funnel and acquisition, but also the expansion side of the business and net retention and launching new products and activating and putting that in front of existing users. I found that really cool, and kind of similar thread there you've written about in a couple of posts, this idea of like the integrated marketing function. And you admittedly kind of hate the term.
Yeah, because it's a bad, it's like, of course it's integrated. Like, that's not a separate thing. Marketing should be.
Yeah, but you demystified it. Like you said, it's basically marketing where teams aren't set up in silos with adjacent priorities, like hashtag one team, one goal. And if you had to give advice to like a massive reorg or you're starting from scratch, what does the ideal structure look like for growth or marketing to avoid having these sub-team silos?
Oh, yeah, it really depends on the business model. I think sometimes the swim lanes, like, I'm kind of contradicting myself here a little bit by saying like it is helpful to have different squads with different swim lanes. I think that is actually helpful because then people have like very clear KPIs and focus, and you know exactly which part of the playbook is not working. For example, we have an acquisition, we call them acquisition on purpose because their entire job is to deploy paid media. Like, it's basically our performance marketing team, but we don't call them performance marketing because their entire job is to deploy paid media in an efficient way to get that first sign up, right? So that's like a squad that's like hyper-focused on that, and they have like a CPL target and a volume target and all of that. So I am a fan of like these clear swim lanes, but I'm also a fan of like looking at all of those metrics and the entire ecosystem in one unified way. Like, we have a lot of insights from looking at it like that, which includes things like, oh, this month, you know, we had all of these signups that we know will never convert to paid. So we need to turn that particular dial off. We know that because that we've done something like that before. We've attracted that ICP or that persona before, blah, 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 right? So I think just like looking at it in a unified way, but not necessarily always operating in a super integrated way is kind of what I'm advocating for. And you need that glue. You need some people and some functions to play that glue between all these teams. And I think that most companies I've worked at, but also observed, and where I have friends and peers, they kind of pick one or the other. Either they're super integrated or they're super siloed. Like, there's kind of like, and really what everybody needs is like this like perfect in between, which is hard. That takes work. We actually promoted from internally and have a chief of staff now for now COO. He's sort of that glue for us so far, which has been really good because he did a lot of our planning for this fiscal year around exactly what every squad's metrics are going to be. How are we going to measure them? What is the actual, there's like a few of us who are VPs. All of us will basically have shared metrics at the top end, but then each of us have like those down funnel metrics that we need to really care about. And he did all of that planning and it was amazing. So that's an integrated marketing function, if you think about it.
I want to switch gears a little bit. You've written a little bit about your pride in discovering and nurturing and up-and-coming marketing rock stars. I'm sure in your position, you work with some fantastic marketers and have worked with them over the course of your career. You've already mentioned like the chiefs of staff being promoted from within. So like, this is probably a trend that you're very familiar with. Walk us through your approach for discovering some of these future rock stars, and what are some of the early signs and qualities you look for them? For in people like this and stuff our listeners can think about when they're trying to cultivate their own career path?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I will admit, this is crude, but I feel like my bar has changed. And I also, this is probably my age, but I feel like I also get annoyed a lot more easily. So I think what I used to look for is not anymore what I look for now. So I'm not sure quite exactly how to answer that question. But for me, it boils down to just like a couple of very key things. One of them is just like, are you like a curious and smart person? I know everybody says this, but there's ways that it manifests in marketing and growth that is like very clear and specific. I actually like love when people like poke and prod and kind of like are, you know, I'll illustrate with an example. People post all sorts of Slack updates, right? I'm sure your company is too, right? Maybe people will be like, oh my God, I had this win. I ran this experiment, blah, blah, blah. And then I watch who's asking questions, you know, particularly if it's outside their domain and their area of expertise, who's asking questions? What kind of questions are they? And I just really admire people that are like a bit like a, you know, dog with a bone. They just won't let something go. There's something weirdly, like morbidly, like amazing about that. Cause like, you're just not going to let it go, you know? And then like you have that grit, you have that perseverance, or you have that obsession that's developed. That's kind of cool. So I love that. I can be like that. It's annoying to other people, but I think that's an interesting quality. And I hope it doesn't sound like posturing. Like, I'm not advocating for you to posture like that. It's just how some people are. And that's a good quality for a function like growth and marketing, which is truly, really both left-brained and right-brained. And you need that perfect balance. So that is like one. And adjacent to that is, I'd say like people that are like very coachable and willing to know where they kind of have gaps and perhaps fail and want to do something about it. You may not be able to do something about it right away. I mean, I have a lot of gaps and I've tried, and there's some gaps that I just can't fill because I just maybe don't have that capacity of my brain just doesn't work that way or whatever, but I try. And so that's another thing I look for, is like coachability in the form of like, are you aware, and are you willing to do something about it, or at least try, put your first foot forward.
Very cool. I love that answer. It actually reminds me it brings me back to 2019 when I interviewed with Consus, and you were the person interviewing me. So you had posted, you were hiring 3 or 4 different roles at Consus. You were just like starting to roll out the team, and I didn't get selected, but you sent me a rejection letter and you offered to,
I don't remember this at all,
give me feedback. Okay. Well, like I'm going to
on the spot
refresh you a little bit.
You actually have that still?
Yeah. I found the email as I was writing this question, and it's all positive, honestly, because like you offered feedback that actually became a career turning point for me. You were telling me that I didn't get selected, and you were like happy to jump on a call and offer you feedback if you're curious about it. And so I took you up on it, and you expanded on some of my shortcomings in the assignment part of the interview. You said that I didn't tailor it as sufficiently to Superside. I didn't ask enough questions. So it ended up being very crucial for me. And it kind of echoed what you just said in your answer about like not the posturing, but someone asking a bunch of questions, you know, like not just taking something and kind of doing it. But I've applied this to future interviews, like since I got that feedback from you. And I think that it's like played a role in helping me land jobs at Close and WordPress. And I took the time to deeply customize take home assignments. And before I started doing anything, I asked like all of the questions and pestered them with like a bunch of stuff and was trying to like show where my brain was going with like some of the questions. But first of all, thank you for the transformative feedback. I hope that I didn't scare you with like bringing this back up, but I'm curious to hear like, why do rejection letters suck so much in our industry? And why did you kind of like have this idea of like just offering feedback? Do you still do that today? Just curious your take there.
I think they suck because often it's not the hiring manager doing the rejection. You know, we all have these like systems, right? Like an HR or recruiting has instituted, and then they hit a button with a template. That's the standard rejection. That's really what happens. Even if it looks like it comes from the hiring manager, often it isn't. So that's issue number one. This whole scalability just takes personality out of it. But if I think what I've tried to do is like if someone was like a total dud, it's like, there's, I can't spend any time with them. Like, this is not going to go anywhere. So like, I just cut that loose, right? It's like, I can't do that. But if someone's like, I was like, ooh, they came really close. And like, there's something here. And by the way, I might hire them later for something else, either at this job or somewhere else, or maybe heck, they might hire me, right? Because it's all like incestuous, right? Like everyone knows everybody. Like we all know, we probably know like 500 people in common, Phil. So, you know, I kind of try to think about, could this like translate into, I mean, I never expected for you to say what you said. I didn't expect you to apply that feedback so quickly, but I always just try to think about like, could this actually be helpful in some ways and selfishly both to you, but also to me. So
very cool.
Yeah. And so I definitely don't do it for everybody. And you can also tell who would be open to it and who's not. Like I interviewed this one lady who's like very, very, very senior at a very fancy pants company. And it was bad. Like, and you know, she didn't ask for feedback and I didn't offer feedback. And even if I offered it, she said, okay, I think she's pretty set in her ways. So I was like, what's the point?
Yeah. One question just throughout the whole interview, something that's really come evident talking to you, Amrita, is just like, and you mentioned this too, like this, marketers are left-brained and right-brained. And I think as a VP of marketing, combining these two skill sets when you're managing, you know, a team and getting results, like, it's challenging to be a marketer, but most of marketing, I'd argue, is pretty fun. It's pretty enjoyable once you get the hang of what you're doing in marketing. But like, how do you combine all of this? How do you kind of synthesize the right and left, the analytics, the results, the testing with like the intuition, the how do I get people to feel a certain way about my brand to take an action? And then how does this manifest in terms of like your internal communications and working with people like the stakeholders?
Part of it's like knowing kind of like what you don't know. It's like you don't want it to be the whole Dunning-Kruger situation where you won't always be able to see around the corners. You won't always know kind of what you don't know, but you kind of roughly have an idea of what you don't. Like even at ClickUp, I was like, kind of don't really know how, you know, why customers choose us. Why not Asana or Monday or friggin' Smartsheets or Notion? Like there's like so much overlap in our industry. Like I don't actually know. And I looked at all our competitive research and our intel and the win-loss, and then the answer was still eluding me. It's like, we don't really know. So it's sort of like, kind of back to that point I was making about that curiosity and that dog with a bone thing. Like you just kind of like some things you just can't let go and you want to like try to dive deep and truly answer it for yourself. Not because someone wrote it on a piece of paper and like, oh, we have our win-loss analysis, but like truly like why? So I think like for me, it always starts from there. I will say I rely on people to give me conclusions to things that I don't understand. Like sometimes, like for example, there's like people on our data and analytics team where I'll be like, okay, thanks for this data, but I actually don't know how to interpret this. And I will be very upfront with them. I was like, I don't know what this is telling me. What are your conclusions from it? And I'll get them to say it to me in English. And then I'll be like, ah, okay, now I can apply this to my world or to another world. And I also go like a little bit of the extra mile where if I think there's an application for that information elsewhere in our ecosystem, maybe it's our user growth team, maybe it's our product team, I will pass it on. So like I kind of just do the extra, and then you, not that I expect for that to happen in return, but it's just a good way for everyone to know that, hey, this is an interconnected ecosystem. There's stuff that's going to like pop up and surface. And we should all be keeping each other informed. So I try to just rely on like smart people to tell me some of the stuff and marry the intuition on just like generally what the trends are and how people purchase. As a consumer myself, of course, I can tap into my own psyche, but also just observing how people around me purchase and how they make those decisions. You know, the one thing that is like super clear now is like, the classic funnel like is totally broken. It's not linear anymore. You know, buyers jump around. They do all sorts of stuff. Most of their research is sometimes anonymous and offsite. It's not actually happening on your site, right? So like all of those dynamics tell you that you actually don't know anything. So at the most basic level, at the absolute basic level, my job is to get my brand in front of that perfect consumer over and over and over. So we are top of mind. If I just did just that, if I just did mm-hmm. that in an efficient way, half my job is done, right? And then the rest of it is like going to follow. So I try to just like demystify stuff for myself and not overthink.
Very cool. Such a powerful answer. There's so many threads I want to pull on that, but we're close on time and I want to hit you with one last question, kind of a two-parter question, if you will. So I would love to ask you about your perspective on the startup grind. And if you think that that's softened a little bit with the shift to remote work and this like greater awareness of boundaries and work-life balance. I know that you're a mom now. You were pulling 60 plus hour weeks at Superside in the early days. Do you think that that's something that you still expect out of your team, even at a bigger company now? Do you think that there is a path to becoming a VP while also not trying to like burn yourself out and prioritizing boundaries? But curious your take there, because like that's very related to the last question we ask all of our guests on the show. Like you're a mother, a VP of marketing, a mastermind group leader, a night owl. You said you're a Jedi in training. One question we ask all of our guests, like I said, is like, how do you remain happy and successful in your career? And how do you find that balance between everything you're working on?
Oh my God. Happiness. Yeah. yeah, no easy answer. I hope my boss doesn't hear this, but I will say that you kind of really have to know like deep down what is super, super, super important to you. And like for me, it has to be like, even if it's a grind, I don't mind the grind, but it has to be fun. And for it to be fun, the one key component for me is camaraderie. Like I know I need that. I know others don't need that, but I know I need that. So that fun piece and the camaraderie piece is super important to me. And I had that at Superside, which is why I never felt like a grind. They were also remote from day one before the pandemic. So that really allowed me to be flexible with my day. So for example, a lot of our team was in Europe. So they were like 6 hours ahead of me. So I would like be like in a lot of meetings and get a lot of stuff done. And then by 2 o'clock, it would taper off because it was like 7 o'clock for them, right? So it would taper off. And then I had from 2 to 6 to do my own stuff, do my own thinking. Of course, we had teammates in Toronto and sometimes we would go to the co-working space and whatever and meet up and stuff. But I just had a lot of flexibility with how I planned my, and I had the camaraderie and the fun aspect because as we talked about earlier in the episode, there was a lot of leeway around how to run experiments and all of that stuff. I would say that's less possible at a larger company like ClickUp, because there's a lot of players. We're all in a very similar time zone. So you actually don't get that reprieve of like the constant notifications and whatnot. And I think the stakes are a lot higher. So interestingly, you would think, oh, startup, lack of resources. So like you're working 60 hour weeks, but the dynamic is actually very different. And the stakes are strangely lower than when you're a big company and you're trying to go from 200 million to 300 million in 1 year, right? Like it's just a different game and almost nothing in that system could fall apart. And you certainly don't want to be the person who's making that system fall apart, right? Because it just like looks bad and it hurts your reputation. So yeah, I'd say that there's no real balance, but I know in my core what I need to be successful and to be happy. And for that, it has to be fun and I have to have good peeps around me that I can jam with and do that. And when I don't have that, and I've told my boss this, like it's not going to work for me. I'm at a point in my career where I can't tolerate that anymore. That is very, very important to me. Mm-hmm. So, because it is a grind no matter where you go, you know, it doesn't matter what stage of company or you are working that many hours and you're giving all your IP, your entire being to a company to let it go from 200 to 300.
Very cool. Awesome answer. I like that you figured that out, the fun part, the camaraderie. I feel like it took me a bit of time to figure like what were those elements for me too. And I think part of discovering it is just like trying startups and like discovering new things. Like I have so many friends and mentees that work in like government in Ottawa, right? And I'm just like trying to get them in tech, like try a startup, like discover new things. You don't know what those elements are until you try different things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's different for everybody. Like I have people tell me on the team, like, money matters a lot to me. Like, money is the number one thing to me. That's me motivated. And there's nothing wrong with that. People want to feel valued, and everyone feels valued in a different way. So yeah, it's just like the answer is like really different for everybody. But I've just given up striving for this like fictitious balance. There is no such thing. There's no such thing. I mean, it's tech. Like, you know, if you're going to be in a role where you're carrying the bag, like where you're like literally carrying like a revenue number, like there's bound to be like very little quote unquote balance. If you want that balance, you should be in a different function. Go to HR, maybe heck even go to engineering, because like you can code and then go, you know, done. But when you're in marketing or you're in sales or you're in growth, like everything you do is incremental and it adds to that revenue pile.
Yeah, definitely agree. Thank you so much for your time, Amrita. This was super fun. I feel like there's like 3 or 4 more episodes we could have done on this, pulling threads on your answers. But yeah, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Folks, thank you so much for listening this far. We really appreciate you being here. I just wanted to call out 2 things before we go. Number one, the best way to support the show is by signing up for our newsletter on humansofmartech.com. We send you a quick email every Tuesday morning letting you know what episode just dropped. We include our favorite takeaways, so if you don't have time to listen to that one, no pressure. We have you covered with some learnings anyway. And number 2, proceeds from sponsors this year have allowed us to venture into video. We recently launched a YouTube channel where we publish full-length episodes, so if you want to see our radio faces, check that out. That's it for now. Really appreciate you listening again. Thank you so much.